found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Start your workday off right with the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard every weekday morning right here at LATalkRadio.com, live, streaming, free apps, download to your iPhone, your tablet, your Android phone, listen on demand, also here and at MariaSanchezShow.com. The technical issues got resolved yesterday, yay, and TheMariaSanchezShow.com. Thank you so much for your ears. We appreciate it. We know you've got lots of choices out there, and we're honored that you take the time to hear what's going on in this world. It is Thursday, June 6th, and we are live. My dad's got his procedure this afternoon. I actually spoke with him. I'm not much of a telephone person. I prefer, which I can't believe, texting or emails. And coming back from the studios yesterday morning, I thought, what the heck, I'll call him. And he was in great spirits. He hasn't been able to walk since he fell on Monday and had the spiral femur fracture and then bleeding on the brain and ripped open his elbow and all that sort of thing. He's back in the hospital that he was in March for an outpatient procedure that was botched and went terribly bad. He almost bled to death. So that 2 to 3 hour procedure ended up being a 3+ week stay in the hospital. So the fact that he's back, the nurse is like, "You're back." And I was there for that many days. And they're such great folks. And he sounded like he's in great spirits. So the procedure is this afternoon at 12:30. He has been getting communion. We're Catholic in the hospital. And a priest is coming today. We Catholics believe in sacraments, and the priest is going to be administering. It's called the Sacrament of the Living. It used to be called Anointing of the Sick, and when I was a little girl, it was called Extreme Unction. So they've taken some of the voodoo out of what it is, and so my dad mentioned that. He also mentioned the power of prayer. Got fingers crossed and hope everything's going to be okay. The good news was my sons come for dinner every Wednesday night. Last night was no exception. My eldest wasn't there because the woman that he's seen, it was her birthday yesterday, which I totally understand. But we do every Wednesday, tried and true, week in, week out. And they've started a new thing, my sons with me, is that they're cooking every other week. But last night was my turn. So I did a pork loin roast with all kinds of vegetables, and everyone was very happy. And then my sons baked cookies, so much for the health conscious. We've got on the program this morning the president of the state of California's Grange Movement, which is an organization that started in 1867, and he's going to be visiting with us. They have had a resurgence here in California, unlike the National Grange Movement, so we're going to go into details about that. And then we have a young man that has been honored with a Fulbright scholarship. He's going to be speaking with us later in the program from the Ukraine, where he's currently serving as a Peace Corps volunteer. This is the future of our country. We're in good hands. I'm just so pleased to say that. But the top stories that are in the news this morning, the top one, I believe, is that President Obama's administration admitted this morning that it is indeed collecting a massive amount of telephone records from at least one carrier, that would be Verizon, over 121 million clients they have as of the first quarter of this year. A senior administration official said the court order pertains only to data such as telephone number or the length of a call and not the subscriber's identities. This came about because the UK newspaper The Guardian published a secret court order that related to the records of millions of the Verizon Communications customers on its website yesterday. So it's in the news this morning. This, of course, on the heels of the Associated Press journalists calling records that they searched and the emails of the Fox television reporter as well. And interestingly enough, the ACLU has issued a statement today. They're condemning it. They're saying that it perhaps is violating our First and Fourth Amendments. So that story is unfolding as we speak. The second largest U.S. lottery jackpot winner has stepped forward. After more than 2 weeks, she is an 84-year-old woman, Gloria McKenzie. She has four children. It was the fifth ticket that she purchased for the drawing. It was a quick pick ticket. The lottery, as you may recall, was $590.5 million Powerball dollars. And she has opted for the lump sum. And so she is going to get, this is before taxes, where does it say? I have it here. Oh, wait, here it is on this story. Sorry. $370.8 million before taxes instead of the 30 annual payments of $19 million. You think? She's 84 years old. But there's a backstory to this story. There was a woman in line at the store where the winning ticket was sold, a Quick Pick Publix, on May 18th, and this gal, the winner, stepped in front of a woman who was in line. And so the 10-year-old said, "Mom, there's a lady in front of us." And she said, "Go ahead." So it was a move that could have cost that woman who allowed the 84-year-old to step in front of her the winning ticket. But who knows? I've never bought one of these. I'm never going to win because I don't buy a ticket. But so that's the story, is that one, this gal stepped forward, and two, she even admitted, too, that somebody let her step forward, and so she claimed the prize. So you can't win if you don't buy. Another story that's been making national news that had something happen interesting to it yesterday. I don't know if you've been following this sweet little 10-year-old girl who has cystic fibrosis, and she's on death's door. And she's been on the pediatric donor list for 18 months, but the problem is there's a federal policy that puts children under the age of 12 at the bottom of the list of those who can receive donated adult lungs. So yesterday, a federal judge ordered that she be allowed to be moved to the adult lung transplant list, thus giving her a better chance of receiving the potentially life-saving transplant, although they say there's no guarantee. But it makes it more likely that a suitable donor will become available in time. And the pictures of this young girl lying in bed with the mask on with the oxygen, because, of course, cystic fibrosis affects the lungs. And I happen to personally know two families that have two children each that have cystic fibrosis. One of the families, he's a dear friend of my son's, and he's in his 20s, which the cystic fibrosis sufferers have been able to live longer thanks to modern medicine and science. But their buddy, the last time they saw him, his mom had to tie his shoes. He was tethered to an oxygen tank. He was too weak to drive, so they went and picked him up, and they went out to lunch. And they basically said it was like saying goodbye to him. Well, he got a lung. He was on the list. He got a lung transplant. He is now, they say it's night and day. He's regained weight. He is going to finish his college education. His mood obviously has improved greatly because he was in a state of depression. And another girlfriend's family, I went to high school with her. We took a camping trip when the kids were in grade school. And that was when I got to see it firsthand what they had to do every night with the inhalers. And then at that time, they were pounding the chest to have the mucous membranes be released and everything. So the 10-year-old's name is Sarah Murnaghan, and she may only live a few weeks without the transplant, and they're saying that now there's hope. So here's a story that I'm ambivalent about what to decide on the outcome of this. Who, in your estimation, who's at fault here? There's the Miss World pageant. It's having their annual event this year on September 28th. On the resort island of Bali and in Sentul, which is an area near the capital of Jakarta. Okay, you think, well, it's Miss World. It's an exotic location. Great. So the fact also remains that Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. And Miss World is based in London. And they are up in arms about the bikini part of the pageant. And because of that, Miss World is not going to have the bikini part of this year's pageant in Indonesia. Instead, they're going to replace it with a conservative beach sarong that is going to be designed specifically for the event. So I understand that we need to be sensitive to people's needs and their pursuits. But if this is something that has been a tradition since the 50s, then should they not have thought about that? Like, okay, this is a Muslim country, the world's most populous Muslim country. They say most Muslims in Indonesia, which is a secular country of 240 million people, are moderate, but there is a small extremist fringe that has become more vocal in recent years. By the way, last month, Lady Gaga was forced to cancel her sold-out concert in Indonesia because there were threats by an Islamic hardliners who called her a devil worshiper. So I'm thinking, okay, so this is what Miss... Now, I'm not a fan of beauty pageants, by the way, and I actually don't really care for the bikini portion myself. I just think that's putting women as objectifying them and their sex objects and all that sort of thing, which I don't think was to our highest good. But regardless, it's not up to me. This is what the Miss World has done. So they are catapulting, I guess. So if they, maybe they should think better before they put something that they've been doing on in, make it more congruent with the country that they're in. That would be my guess. So we're going to be speaking now with Bob McFarland, who is the president of the State of California Grange, and talk with him about the organization and the fork to farm philosophy and how and why they're having a resurgence in their membership here in the state of California.
Good morning, Maria.
Hi, Bob. Good morning. Thank you for being available and being on the air with the Maria Sanchez Show and for speaking with us about the California State Grange. And do you want to give us an overview, since you've been around, I don't know that you specifically in California, but the organization has been around since 1867.
That's correct. Yes, we've the California State Grange is the oldest agricultural organization in the country. And we have 10,000 members in 185 communities in California. And it's an organization that started with an interest and a focus on agriculture. We're returning to that focus. A lot of our grange halls are old. They've been around as early as the late 1800s. And what happened over a period of 140 years is towns grew up around those halls. So the Grange adapted and also does a lot of community service besides its focus on agriculture.
So interesting that the Grange was initially in an agricultural area and then communities developed around them. So they find themselves probably now industrialized.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, Sacramento, the Bay Area, Los Angeles area. These Granges back in 1870, 1880 were rural communities and served mostly that rural community and those farmers. Well, I think we're seeing a return to that focus on farming and agriculture.
Now, I'm going to go from specific to general and back, but specifically for the state of California, what kind of organization are you considered? Are you a nonprofit, not-for-profit, just grassroots?
We are a mutual benefit, nonprofit, fraternal organization. So you become a member of the Grange to join the organization.
And who can join?
Anybody can join. Anybody over the age of 5 years old can join, and we welcome everybody.
And I saw that there's an application on your website, and you joined the state, or you join the community, or you join the national, or what are you joining?
You can join any of those three branches. Typically, though, a member will become familiar with their local Grange and will join their local Grange, and then they're automatically a member of the state Grange, and they can become a member of the national Grange.
And by joining, what benefits are you gaining, or why should somebody join a local Grange?
Well, you know, the Grange provides an opportunity for people to give back to their communities, and that's a generalization. And if you have a particular interest, say in a particular type of farming, you know, that attracts a lot of people. We have a full full-blown legislative program where becoming a member of the Grange allows you to speak with the voice of 10,000 members in the state of California. And we work on legislation. So it's an organization that can serve your community, can serve your state, and if we are able to get laws passed, we can serve our state and our country.
Now, I understand, Bob, that in general, the participation and the membership has been declining not only in the state but in the country, and that California has reversed that and shown a resurgence. What do you attribute that to?
I attribute that to a new group of young people, and when I say young, anybody under the age of 60, a new group of an energy from young people in California that are kind of returning to the land, and they want to farm, and particularly they're interested in sustainable agriculture and organic farming. And they believe that they can better serve their communities if the farming is local rather than having their produce shipped from 1,000 or 5,000 miles away. And I think that's where the resurgence of interest in the Grange is coming from.
Now
we've had. Go ahead.
It's interesting though that you're reversing what's happening nationally. Now, I know the state of California, we're a little more progressive than the rest of the country in general, and then because we're so big and populous, and then we have so much land that is devoted to agriculture, it kind of seems like it's the perfect confluence of interests. But wouldn't you think that other people would be interested in that too, the farm-to-fork sort of thing, or organic?
Absolutely, because I think there's a movement of interest across the country from consumers in what they're eating, where it comes from, how it's grown. The Grange was very instrumental in getting Proposition 37 on the ballot last fall. We helped in turning in that nearly 1 million signatures, and that was the ballot measure that asked that GMO products be labeled. And we're not drawing any conclusions in California at this point whether GMO products are good or bad. We're simply saying the consumer has a right to know if those food items have been genetically modified.
And how is that going?
Well, Proposition 37 lost by a narrow margin. It was a grassroots effort, and the Grange is a grassroots organization. So without any money, without any connections or anything, a Grange member in Chico started that movement, and in a year and a half she got it on a ballot. That's pretty amazing. You don't see that happen very often. And that shows you the level of interest in California from these young people that want to help people have healthier lifestyles and the foods they eat and building up their communities in the schools, teaching the kids, planning for our children's future. That's what the Grange is really doing in California right now.
So now let's talk about California's relationship with the National Grange.
Okay.
Or the lack thereof, I might say. Why don't you give us a little background? Because you're in the news since they revoked your charter.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate, Maria. The organization is 145 years old. You know, like any organization or any family or any two people, we have our differences. And we've come across some differences between the National Grange and the California State Grange. The National Grange does not believe that our leadership here in California is behaving in accordance with our rules. And those are all internal rules. We don't agree with that. So we've got this argument going on between the National Grange and California State Grange. I will say that I'm somewhat optimistic that will be solved. We're talking about sitting down, as we should, as Grange members and trying to solve this.
So can you let our listeners know specifically where the differences lie on and what those issues are?
Well, there are people out there that want to make it, want to circle around some kind of conspiracy issues having to do with the difference between the political views of the National Grange, which are more traditional, than, as you said before, the progressive views of the California State Grange. But nevertheless, we are allowed to have a difference of opinion. The National Grange recognizes that as well. I don't agree with the conspiracy theories. I think this is more an internal matter and a question of our internal rules and whether we are abiding by them or not. I can't get into specific details about what those rules are because I am sworn to keep certain things about the Grange within the membership.
Is it true that the National Grange lobbies for big agriculture and supports the use of pesticides and GMOs?
Yes, that's their current policy. Policy for the National Grange and for the State Grange is set by the members. So there's a resolution process that comes up through the channels, and if the membership of the National Grange or the California State Grange approves those resolutions, then that becomes, those become the marching orders for whoever the leadership is to support.
But you just said that the California, at least the newer chapters that have been popping up, are against those things philosophically.
Yes, we have some differences philosophically. For example, California is not so certain about GMOs, and we believe they should be labeled. The National Grange does not support that view, and they believe that there is no difference between GMO and non-GMO products. That's a big one. That's the one that's in everybody's forefront right now. There are other things. For example, California is pretty much anti-pesticide, which goes along with organic farming and sustainability. The National Grange doesn't believe that some of these pesticides that we're complaining about are necessarily harmful. Those are some examples. It breaks down really between sustainable agriculture and what people do to have organic crops and more conventional agriculture, which tends to be larger agriculture and sometimes owned by corporations and so forth.
But
within the Grange, there's room for all of those philosophies. The general idea is we want to help farmers, and we want to help consumers and educate consumers.
So since the National Grange revoked the state of California's charter in April, and there's a suit going on in Superior Court, what is your status?
Well, the California State Grange, the charter of the California State Grange is revoked. Underneath the California State Grange, under our umbrella, are 185 community granges. Those community granges, if I understand the specifics of this, are not affected by the revocation of the California State Grange. So the National Grange takes the position that they are now the umbrella for all of those community granges. We don't agree with that, and I think a lot of our community granges don't necessarily agree with that. The granges in California have been a family for 143 years, and we want to continue to be in the family. So that's the general controversy there, and that's what the court case is about. We're looking at those legal questions, and hopefully it will be resolved soon.
Because I understand, too, that California, the granges are fairly, there are some unique ones in the state that are not in the nation. So it seems like you've got a nice eclectic kind of cross-cultural sort of formulation.
Absolutely. I'm really honored to be chosen as the leader for the Granges of California. We've got great diversity. We're trying different things. You said before that the membership has been declining. It's true. In California, we had been declining in membership for 30 years up until 2009, and we finally saw a net growth. And I attribute that to the fact that we have diversified and opened up our halls to a variety of people, whether they be organic farmers or theater groups or dance groups, or people interested in supporting our troops, sending packages. The great thing about the Grange is every Grange decides how it can best serve its community. We do not dictate what they're supposed to be doing in their communities. It's really a unique organization in that way.
Well, and Bob, I also understand that not only has California increased in its membership, but you've also reduced the average age significantly.
Yeah, we did a study in 2007 that showed the average age of a Grange member in California was 64, 65. And our latest study shows that age has been reduced to 45, which just shows you the dynamic change we've seen in California. We've had close to 4,000 new members join the Grange since 2009. Now, of course, there's attrition. You know, we lose people to age, people move away, so forth and so on. Yeah, it's really drawing in these people that I call the displaced sons and daughters of the American family farm. You know, we mm-hmm. don't have nearly as many small family farms anymore because they've sold their farms off, and now the sons and daughters they have farming in their blood, and they've found a home in the Grange that will support them and try to find them a place to farm. We're working on starting an ag school over in the Willits area that will allow a lot of these farmers to work together and educate each other. It's really exciting stuff. We're doing a lot of farmers markets and food co-ops. And just last night I was at a lot of our granges are becoming delivery points for the CSA programs, which is where a farm will put their produce in a box and they have subscriptions to people the consumers that will eat that food. It's very interesting. It's very healthy, and it's taking on across the country. This has been people's interest.
Well, I have a little story because I have I live in a suburban area, but I have a garden in my backyard, and for the first time I grew corn. Didn't really look into the philosophy of how you're supposed to plant it. So fortunately, I planted it the way you're supposed to. I found that out over the weekend when I Googled it. But I've got these things coming up, which turned out to be tassels, and they're not ears of corn. And I guess the corn, the wind gets, and I didn't know where to turn or what to do. So I go to Facebook, and nobody's helping me there. So then I go back to Google to find out. So I would imagine that you can address some kinds of those issues.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, Maria, because here I am, the president of the oldest agricultural organization in the country, and honestly, I can't even grow a chia pet. So, you know, when you talk to me about growing corn, more power to you. I go out and I work in these community gardens with our members and so forth, and I learn from that experience. If you really want to know how to grow corn or anything else, my recommendation would be is look up your local Grange, because without a doubt, there'll be somebody there that knows how to do it the right way.
I'm going to do that. Because I don't think it's too late, based on what I've been learning, that the tassels are, and so they're, and what I have been doing is blowing on them to spread their pollen so that that it maybe it'll help. And then I think, oh, Mother Nature, she's been doing it for decades, centuries.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll work out.
Well, the first decision you have to make is the type of seeds you buy. Do you want to buy heirloom seeds? In other words, these are seeds that are non-GMO seeds. Or do you want to buy, say, the Monsanto version of corn? That's the first question you ask yourself. And a little bit of studying as a consumer, somebody who's going to eventually eat that corn, you can decide which product you want to grow.
You know what I found for the first time, because I don't start with seeds. I start with something that's a seedling. And that they were marked organic and non-GMO. And I had never seen that before. I guess either I wasn't paying attention or maybe they're more aggressive with that. I live in Southern California, so I don't know what to say. But, of course, I bought organic and non-GMO whenever it was available to me.
Sure. I think that's a healthy choice.
So what do you think are the odds that you and the Papa Bear are going to be able to get some resolution here?
Oh, boy, Papa Bear and me. Well, you know, we've been attending the same meetings so that our members can get both sides of the story. And personally, I think Papa Bear and I get along just fine. These are issues that have to do with the internal workings of the Grange. And again, we've been around 145 years, and this is not the first time we've been through these type of issues. I'm confident that we'll come out of this thing, all of us, maybe better off for it, maybe a little more educated. Maybe we'll see some changes at the National Grange level that will make things better. But the Grange is the Grange. You can't. It will be here. It will be here for this generation and the next. And I guess that's the most important thing. Whatever happens between Papa Bear and myself, I'm confident the Grange will survive.
Well, and I would suggest that perhaps these are growing pains that got a little bit ugly.
You know, that's a good theory. We just took off like a rocket. I mean, we've organized or reorganized 30 new Granges since 39 new Granges since 2009 in California. And that was going into, like, we had 10 or 12 vacant Granges and revitalizing those Granges and getting the community in there and starting things, and also the growth from the young farmers and so forth. And maybe we did sort of outgrow our pants and pop a couple of buttons or something. I'm sure that has something to do with this,
and
because it's astronomical.
Before we say goodbye, will you share with our listeners the cute little story about Malibu and using the Grange name?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the National Grange holds the trademark on the name Grange. And I got a call from National Grange, maybe 2 years ago, saying, "Do you have a Grange in Malibu?" And I said, "No, we don't." They said, "Well, we'll take care of it then. Somebody's using our name." And I said, "Well, let me talk to them first. Let's find out who they are." I went to their website, and they're vintners. They grow grapes. And I met with this gal, Sonia, down in Santa Monica, and I said, "Sonia, you know, we've got this trademark. You're a farmer. How about we start a new chapter, a new Grange chapter, and then you can use the name Malibu Grange?" And she said, "That's fine." And we worked on that for a while and got our people together, and Sonia and her husband, Emilia Estevez, the actor, are the vintners. And so we have a wonderful group of Grangers down there that started the Malibu Grange.
There you go. That's what a typical California story that is. And Bob McFarland, the president of the state of California Grange, what contact information do you want to share?
Our phone number is best, 916-454-5805.
And what about a website?
californiagrange.org.
Perfect. Bob, thank you for your time and for your optimism. I'd love to visit with you when it all gets resolved so we can put
Excellent.
This behind us. Okay. Take care, Bob. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
So there you have it. They're growing. They're getting younger. And the national organization's like, "No, you can't do that. We want you to make sure that pesticides and GMOs are included." Now we get to speak with an inspirational young man, I'm going to say. He is a California Lutheran University graduate, and he lives in Southern California, but he is now a Peace Corps volunteer in the Ukraine, and he is in the news this week, and we wanted to give him the opportunity to get some kudos and explain just exactly why. His name is Chris Kachtor, and I might have to make it through Google because he's in the Ukraine.
The Google subscriber you have called is not available. Please leave a message after the tone.
The funny thing is, he called while we were on the air with Bob, and I, of course, didn't want to answer it, which is why I like to call the guests. People always say to me, I'll call in, and I'm like, no, because then I might be in the middle of a conversation or a thought, so I'll call you. So we'll try him one more time, because he did call while we were chit-chatting. So he graduated from California Lutheran University, which is here in Southern California. He has a bachelor's degree in sociology and psychology, then got a master's degree in public policy and administration, and then upon that, he joined the Peace Corps, and he's going to complete his service in the Ukraine this summer, and he's got a whole bunch of achievements about that, and then he's moving on to being a...
The Google subscriber you have called is not available.
Okay.
Please leave a message
so
after
we'll
the tone.
And maybe he'll if he calls back, we'll answer. So I wanted to... Here we go. Hi, Chris. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for calling us back. I'm hoping that the conversation is going to be okay because there's a little bit of an echo. I was just sharing with the listeners about your accomplishments as a student at California Lutheran University and then how you
right.
joined the Peace Corps immediately upon your graduation with your master's degree. And you
That's
are
right.
in the Ukraine since 2010?
Yeah, that's right. I started Peace Corps in September of 2010. We started training for 3 months, and then it's a two-year commitment and actually extended for one extra semester.
And
so I can see out my baseball camps and my baseball program here.
So before we go into that, I want to go back just a little bit, because the reason we're speaking to you is that it's been announced this week that you have received a Student Fulbright Award, and you're going to be teaching in Romania starting in this fall. So that's big news. That's a huge accomplishment. Congratulations. Couldn't be more proud of you, homegrown boy. Don't mean to say that derogatorily. But let's talk about what you've done since you've been in the Ukraine, because you've done quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because if you read this article from my university, it makes me look like a hero, but really I'm not. It's just really just being here and showing up and kind of just being aware of what your community needs. And I'm fortunate enough to be in a city. It's pretty big. We have over 400,000 people who live here, and we have a couple of universities, and I teach at one of them. And just a few things, like I did a big, I know the article mentions a Big Brother, Big Sister project, and that was something that I modeled off of Cal Lutheran, actually. I'm a first-generation college student, and when I was there, there's a program there called Student Support Services that really helped me out a lot. And I remember being a senior at Cal Lutheran, and I decided I wanted to give back and mentor someone else, because when you're in that program, they say you'll mentor your freshman year. It kind of helps you. I may help you with, like, counseling with all your courses and things like that. And so I thought, how great is that? And I thought, you know, there's no programs like that out here. And so I initiated that. And what that was, I just took my university student, and there's another Peace Corps volunteer who lives in a city pretty close to me, and she has a lot of high school students who, you know, want to come to the university but are a little bit scared. They haven't really been in the big city kind of thing. And so I said, well, let's take my students. And, you know, we'll meet with them once a month. We'll mentor them. They'll take them to a class or two and just kind of see that it's not that big of a deal, you know. So it's just kind of breaking barriers.
So you're taking, you're mentoring, your university students are mentoring this piece, other Peace Corps volunteers, high school students, to show them what it's like to be on campus and what college could be for them?
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, a lot of these students, they come from the village, too. There's a lot of volunteers who live in the villages and work with students there. And so a lot of them don't really see, like, a perspective. They don't really see, like, a big future for them outside of the village, outside of just, you know, being a farmer, just doing whatever there. And so, you know, I kind of want to tell these students, like, no, you can do it too, you know. Here's other students who are just like you doing the same thing. And it's kind of neat to see them come. And I've been here for over two years now, and I've seen some of the students kind of matriculate in, and it's just been a really neat thing to be able to see that.
Now, what is the Ukraine like? Can you describe it in terms of America?
That's a great question. It's one of those things that you really have to be here to experience to be able to tell. I mean, I went back home to the States for the holidays in December and January, and I got that same question, and I was stumped. It's so hard to explain. But one of the things I would say is that, you know, people really care. They're pretty wonderful, but in terms of, like structure and like roads and things like that, like it's pretty much a second world country. But they do have education, they have running water, they have things like that. That's why, you know, it's more of a second world, not a third world. But I think the biggest thing that's holding back Ukraine, because it is so close to Europe, it's right next door to Poland, to Hungary, to Romania, to all these countries that are really progressing. They progressed really fast after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Ukraine is kind of still like held back a little bit. And since I've been here for a while, I've kind of realized it's not, you know, money, it's not any of these things, it's mentality. And when I went through like Poland, I went to Hungary because I have some family there, in Romania as well, and I talked to people, I realized their mentality is just different. Like, they wanted to get rid of the past. They didn't want any part of that. They tore down their old building. They tore down the Lenin statues and all those things. In Ukraine, they still have it. And so what I do is, on my first day of class and my last day of class, I give my students a quote, and I tell them, you know, it all starts with you. And the quote, it pretty much just says, the quote is this. It says, I kept looking for somebody to do something until I realized that I was somebody. And I think that hits home to a lot of them, because, you know, they travel around too. They, you know, they have the internet. They're all hooked up. They see things, and they want that for their country too. Another big thing I see is freedom. Like, only this younger generation now is getting used to that idea, and their parents, like, haven't had it for so long. Mm-hmm. And these young students, they're still not sure what to do with it. And I remember my first day in class, the student said something that just kind of shook my mind. I said, you know, what do you expect from me as your teacher? Like, yeah, I'm going to teach you English, but I'm going to teach you more. What do you expect from me? Not from America, whatever. And this student in the back of the class, he just said a thing. He said, we want to know what to do with our freedom.
Oh, my.
And I didn't really know what to say to that, you know.
Now, how do they dress, Chris? Do they dress in Western wear?
Kind of. You can tell there's a difference. Ukraine's a little behind, I guess, in terms of dress. Like, I really don't pay attention to that too much. But what I've noticed is they're a couple of years behind the U.S., and everyone wants to kind of emulate the United States. You'll notice, like, a lot of students wearing, like, American flag T-shirts and, like, you know, all those kind of things.
Hmm.
So it's pretty funny.
Tell us about the baseball camps that you helped start.
Yeah, the baseball camp was just kind of brought about because I just kind of wanted something to do, and I wanted to get some of these students who were kind of just sitting on the field, just kind of smoking and hanging out. I wanted to have them do something positive, and I said, you know, let's start playing baseball. And a lot of them were interested because Ukraine has this program with the state. It's called Work and Travel. And a lot of these students go to the States for the summer, and, you know, they work usually like, you know, cities that are pretty touristy, and they work in like shops and things like that. But they get to experience American culture, and they come back, and a lot of these students, they got to see like a different way of life. Like, here, there's not so many extracurricular activities to do. You pretty much just go home. There's not much to do in terms of that. So they were seeing students in the U.S. just playing all types of sports and involved in clubs and dancing. There's just so many opportunities. And when they got back, they were like, yeah, okay, let's do this. And so it kind of just took off. And, you know, it just started with like five students. I had like, you know, three pairs of gloves that were like duct taped together. And it just grew. And I started a camp. I did a camp my first summer. I did a camp again the second summer. And now the university has said that they'll go ahead and take on the a full-time baseball team because it works out for them, too. It's a big recruitment tool for the university, and I think it's great for the students, too.
Now, who are they going to be able to play?
There are some other volunteers, too, who kind of picked up on this. And unfortunately, they're kind of far, but they're, you know, Ukraine's a pretty big country, but they're also like putting this together, so it's kind of like taking storm over here. It's pretty neat thing to see.
So you're kind of creating a league then amongst college baseball teams.
A little bit, yeah. It's pretty exciting actually.
And what about the field that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, it's interesting because we just have this abandoned field that no one really takes care of, and I thought, well, you know, let's do something to make this better. And again, I was faced with that roadblock of like, oh, we can't do that. You know, our administration is bad, or, you know, our government is bad. This is bad. And I said, you know, don't wait for somebody else to do it. Let's do it together. And so, actually, I want to take this opportunity right now to thank the people back home who've helped me and supported me with donations to help make this happen. And we took this old abandoned field and, you know, within 2 months, we just turned it into like a, not the best, but a decent playing field for the students. And, you know, it has a backstop and it has fencing and, you know, we put in new grass and you know, it looks pretty in the dugout and benches. And so that's something that'll be here for a long time. It seems to be able to use that and play on.
Now, are there opportunities for folks here to still continue to help you with whatever needs you may have that are unmet?
Actually, everything is great, and unfortunately, not really not at this point, because I'm leaving at the end of summer, mm-hmm. and that's when I'll start my Fulbright, but I appreciate the offer, and I appreciate
okay.
you asking.
So now let's fast forward to the Fulbright Award and teaching in Romania.
Yeah.
And what are you going to, you're going to be teaching English?
Yeah, that's right. The Fulbright is also a 9-month commitment, and I'll be able to also teach English like I am here. And the reason I'm really excited about that is because my parents are from there.
Oh.
And it's a chance for me to go back there and kind of give back to that to that community as well.
How great is that?
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Like, I just, you know, I'm in love with the States. Like, they're offering me these amazing opportunities to do some really good work and to give back. You know, I grew up as a first-generation American, always hearing stories about, you know, the motherland back home and how lucky we are to be Americans and to have all the opportunities that we have in the States. And I always just thought, my dream, I think, since high school was I want to go back there and I want to see what it's like. And, you know, I want to try to, you know, help make a difference in some way if I can. And, you know, I kind of just put it on the back burner, really thought about it for a while. It was always just in the back of my mind. And then someone told me about the Fulbright, and I said, you know, I'm going to give it a shot. And so many people at Cal Lutheran, when I told them that, just came out to support me and help me. And it's a wonderful thing, and I got it. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, you should be, and congratulations. Now, did you get to pick Romania as to where you wanted to go?
Right, right. In the Peace Corps, you don't choose. They kind of choose for you based off of your skill sets. And actually, the countries choose for the Peace Corps. They say, you know, like Eastern Europe, they want English teachers. And I think in Latin America, they want, you know, nonprofit administration, business development, farming, agriculture, things like that. But with the Fulbright, you get to choose. And you get to be pretty specific. And you get to also say, like, I want to do these projects. I want to teach here. The only thing you don't choose is your city. So
you mentioned,
that doesn't matter. Like, I'm just happy to be there.
It's a 9-month commitment in Romania. And do you have projects that you are going to implement aside from teaching English?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one thing I've done here, which I wish I could have just kind of dedicated more time to and just wish it would have been bigger, is this Becoming a Man program. This is something that's always been close to my heart. Like you said, I'm, you know, homebred. I'm from, you know, the Southern California area. And I went to an all-boys high school in the Valley, went to Crespi. And I took a class my senior year called Becoming a Man. That class changed my life. And I remember getting to Cal Lutheran, to the university. And again, I'm a first-generation college student. And I always thought, you know, I sat in a class and I never went, oh, the quadratic equations have changed my life. But classes like Becoming a Man did change my life, and I remember I wanted that same experience for students as well. And so at Cal Lutheran, I fought for 4 years, and I had a lot of meetings. I met the president and all the heads of the administration. And they said, well, if you want to have this course, you have to show student interest. And I said, okay. And I held a lot of forums and seminars, and I brought in speakers, a couple celebrities and things like that, just to get, you know, the momentum going. And my last semester, my senior year, they said, yeah, we'll take on the course. And it was approved as a Philosophy Becoming a Man in 2007.
So,
and then I stayed on as a graduate student to help TA that class as well. And so that's just been kind of a big part of my life. It's had such an impact on me. And then when I graduated, I asked my mentor at Cal Lutheran, I said, you know, Dr. Schwartz, I want to continue teaching and I want to continue, you know, serving like this. How could I do it? And he said, well, join the Peace Corps. And so here I've been able to do a little bit of that. I helped some, like, it's called, like, I called it, like, leadership, you know, for guys. And I held some, like, seminars, and I started a course and much of that. But like I said, unfortunately, it didn't really take off like I wanted it to. But when I get to Romania, I think that's going to be my main goal, is really to focus on the males. Because not just in the States. I know in the States there's a lot of issues. You know, you'll see in the headlines all the time, guys are failing at the university. They're not really doing well. They're not performing. They're falling behind women, things like that. But out here in Eastern Europe, it's a whole different ballgame. Like, there really is this huge dichotomy between men and women. And it's funny, because women in Ukraine really carry the country. Like, there's a saying that men are the head, but women are the neck.
Yeah.
And so, like, women kind of, like, they show, you know, the man where to go, things like that. But really, like, women are the force behind the country here. They make it happen. And so I think we just bring the level of our boys up to that same level. The country will just prosper.
Well, here's a small side story, Chris. My two brothers went to Crespi. So.
Oh, whoa, that's crazy,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, 3 degrees. And just for the listeners, if you're not, Crespi is a Catholic all-male high school in the San Fernando Valley. So it's a small little world, Chris. I just want to thank you so much for your selflessness. Thank you for your service.
Thank you
for helping to make this world a better place. And congratulations on being awarded the Fulbright Award.
I appreciate that so much. If I can, just real quick say a few more things, because in life you really get an opportunity to do this. But I just want to thank all my mentors and all the people back home who supported me and always believed in me, especially my parents and my friends. And lastly, I want to thank you, Maria, actually, for having the show, because there's a lot of programs out there that are kind of negative and show, like, all the negative sides of man, but I think programs like yours, like, really portray the better sides of humanity, And they provide, like, positive examples for our younger generation, you know? So I thank you for that, and I thank you for making the world a better place, too.
Thank you, Chris. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate our conversation. And we do strive to focus on as much good news as possible. And with that in mind, before we say goodbye, we have a film that's just being released. It's called The Gratitude Experiment. And it's all about the attitude of gratitude and how success lies in living in gratitude. This is the Maria Sanchez Show. Have a great day. Look forward to visiting with you tomorrow. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.